Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tina Foster of the International Justice Network, who discusses the importance of a federal court decision finding that detainees held by the U.S. military in Afghanistan are entitled to challenge their detention in U.S. courts. Gerd Leipold, International Executive Director of Greenpeace, who describes his group's environmental campaigns, both targeting and collaborating with corporations. And Michael Zweig, Professor of Economics at Stony Brook University, who talks about his recent trip to Iraq, where he observed the formation of a new Iraqi labor confederation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports a bill to establish a truth commission about the U.S. role in the ouster of former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004 has stalled. California Congresswoman Barbara Lee has proposed the legislation since 2004, but it has never been voted out of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. But with the new Obama administration, there is hope that a truth commission can now go forward. Aristide, who currently lives in exile in South Africa, insists American diplomats forced him to board a plane to leave Haiti on February 29, 2004, in the midst of an armed attack on the government. Congress only held a single hearing on Aristide's ouster in early March 2004 and failed to place any State Department officials under oath. Nicole Lee of Trans Africa Forum says the Truth Commission should look at the role played by the International Republican Institute, a branch of the Republican Party and the National Endowment for Democracy, in collaborating to remove Aristide from office. Drug giant Pfizer has made an out-of-court settlement over the deaths of 11 children during a 1996 experimental pharmaceutical trial in northwest Nigeria. The Kano state government and Nigeria's federal government had sued Pfizer for $7 billion in damages over the distribution of the medication Trovan during an outbreak of meningitis in 1996 that killed 12,000 people. No details of the settlement were released, with the next court date set for May 25th. Pfizer has pushed for a settlement ever since the pharmaceutical giant lost a U.S. Court of Appeals decision on January 31st, which reinstated a series of lawsuits by Nigerian parties. The appeals court ruled the victims could use the Alien Tort Claims Act to pursue claims against Pfizer in U.S. courts. During the test of experimental antibiotic Trovan, 11 children died and 188 were injured. Pfizer claims proper protocol was used, but the parents never gave authorization for the drug to be dispensed to their children. An investigation by the Nigerian government concluded Pfizer ran an illegal trial of an unregistered drug, and the trial was a clear case of the exploitation of the ignorant. In 2007, a father of one of the victims told the BBC, "The American doctors took advantage of our illiteracy and cheated us and our children. We thought they were helping us." Comprehensive sex education advocates won a rare victory on Capitol Hill when President Obama signed a new appropriations bill that cut $14 million in abstinence-only programs on teenage sexuality. At the same time, the spending bill increased funding for family planning and dedicated more money to domestic HIV/AIDS services. Advocates are also making a renewed push for the Responsible Education About Life Act, also known as the REAL Act, to fund comprehensive sex education programs through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. As a senator, Barack Obama had co-sponsored the REAL Act. Yet there is plenty of resistance to rolling back abstinence-only programs in Congress, especially among the moderate Blue Dog Democrats, reports the news magazine In These Times. However, a series of scientific studies have shown abstinence-only programs are totally ineffective and fare worse in changing teenagers' sexual behavior than comprehensive sex education. New data from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reveal teenage pregnancy is rising nationally for the first time in 15 years. Large increases were seen in Mississippi, New Mexico, and Texas, southern states that use abstinence-only programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Emily Santos Poplowski.
On April 2nd, federal judge John D. Bates for the District of Columbia issued a ruling which allows detainees held indefinitely without charge by the U.S. military in Afghanistan be entitled to challenge their detention in U.S. courts. This same right is accorded by the U.S. Supreme Court to detainees held at the U.S. Guantanamo Naval Base. The case involves three men captured outside Afghanistan who have been imprisoned at the U.S. Bagram Air Base there without charge or trial for 6 years. Although President Obama has ordered the closure of the Guantanamo detention camp, his administration has taken the contradictory position that the Bagram Air Base and its detainees should remain beyond the reach of U.S. courts. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tina Foster, founder and executive director of the International Justice Network, who serves as a lead counsel in several of the Bagram detainee cases. She discusses how this case affects the Bush-era conflict over the power of the judiciary to review executive branch authority, to declare an individual an enemy combatant and imprison them indefinitely. Foster also comments on Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón's launching of an investigation into the criminal authorization of torture authored by six former Bush administration legal advisors under the doctrine of universal jurisdiction.
It's a very significant decision. It's the first time that a U.S. court has looked into the case of any of the thousands of detainees that are being held outside of Guantanamo, but in U.S. custody. While the decision itself, the judge was very careful to specify that it only pertained to the four cases before him, you know, it obviously opens the door to others who are in similar legal black holes to be able to challenge their detention in U.S. courts.
Tina, I wanted to ask you, who were the detainees involved in this case? I understand there were foreign nationals captured outside of Afghanistan and then brought to the Bagram prison, held there for 6 years. But who were they?
For example, one of our clients, Amin al-Bakri was his name. He's a Yemeni father of two, family man, a businessman who was on a trip to Thailand in, I think it was in 2002, when he was abducted and disappeared for several years before his family eventually got a letter from the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the body that monitors some of these detention facilities secretly, under an agreement with the United States government. But he received a letter that was delivered through the International Red Cross, his family did, and at that point contacted local human rights groups who eventually got in touch with us, and we filed the case on his behalf. And since that time, he hasn't been allowed to speak with any attorney. He hasn't been given any process. We don't know why he's being held there. He hasn't been accused of any crime. He's just been languishing in Bagram prison without charge in U.S. custody for the past 6 years, and we're still being denied access to him.
Tina Foster, there are many people in the country who are hoping that when President Barack Obama was elected to the White House that he'd make a clean break with Bush administration policy on accruing to itself enormous powers, according to many, in violation of the Constitution, where the executive branch can hold detainees forever without having any judicial oversight. But disturbingly, in this case, President Obama and his administration hold that the Bagram Air Base was somehow beyond the reach of U.S. courts, even as they stated that they were going to close down Guantanamo. It seemed that they were reserving this spot to hold detainees from all over the world out of the reach of U.S. courts.
This was a Bush administration creation. It predated Guantanamo. And while you know, many of us in the rights community were screaming loudly about Guantanamo, our organization, the International Justice Network, was the only organization until very recently to talk about Bagram. So, you know, I think that the public education campaign that happened for Guantanamo hasn't happened yet for Bagram, and shows like yours are, you know, are doing a great service in having this issue be raised. But I think it's important to remember that Obama's going to have another chance at this, I think, because while they didn't do the right thing when they came back and announced that they weren't going to change the position immediately in the legal cases, you could kind of, give them a little, throw them a little slack because, you know, it was only a month into the administration and some of the people that had to make the key decisions weren't in office yet. At this point, they're at a critical crossroads because they're going to have to decide whether or not they want to appeal this case. And, you know, I think it'll be a pretty good litmus test to see whether this administration wants to spend the time, effort, and resources in defending the prior administration's policy, which it has disavowed, at least as it concerns Guantanamo.
Spanish Judge Baltazar Garzon has opened up a new criminal investigation into Bush administration officials for authorizing torture, and that includes Alberto Gonzalez, David Addington, Douglas Feith, William Haynes, John Yoo, and Jay Bybee. What do you think the effect of Judge Baltazar Garzon's initiating this case will have on the Obama administration to take seriously many people in this country's sentiment that Bush administration officials should be investigated not in Spain, but here in the United States?
The Spanish prosecutor is, maybe the first in a line of people in the international community to come out and say, look, you know, these guys shouldn't be able to get away with some of the things that they've admitted on the record publicly that they've done. I hope that the Obama administration takes that seriously, and I hope, you know, moreover, that it gives them some courage to make more concessions to those that have a independent special prosecutor appointed. I think there's also the possibility for the Obama administration to appoint a commission of inquiry into some of the practices that have happened, because I think we've only scratched the surface. It's only the tip of the iceberg, the torture, rendition, all of these practices that have been going on. I don't think that the American people even know a fraction of what's been done in their name.
That was Tina Foster, Executive Director of the International Justice Network. To learn more about the legal case involving prisoners at the Bagram U.S. Air Base in Afghanistan, visit the network's website at ijnetwork.org. Greenpeace is best known as a direct action environmental organization that sends rubber rafts full of activists to confront whaling ships, tries to shut down nuclear facilities, and hangs huge banners from skyscrapers denouncing dirty coal and other environmental abuses. But the organization has recently also undertaken campaigns to change corporate behavior, and even collaborated with some companies to achieve mutually desirable goals. In a talk at Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies on April 6, Gerd Leipold, the International Executive Director of Greenpeace, spoke about those campaigns, sometimes targeting and unexpectedly collaborating with corporate giants like Apple, McDonald's, and Coca-Cola. Leipold began volunteering with Greenpeace in Germany in 1980. With a background in physics and a Ph.D. in oceanography, Leipold has helped to better ground the organization in science and is one of the leaders who believes corporations can play a positive role. But he knows that progress can be reversed, as when oil giant British Petroleum turned green, but then, with its exploitation of tar sands oil, recently became dirtier than ever. The following is an excerpt of Leipold's talk at Yale University.
Many of you will know that if we do not achieve an effective agreement at the Copenhagen Climate Conference this December, there's almost no chance that we can prevent the world breaking the 2-degree limit beyond which, as science tells us, our children will face a world in which life will be nastier, shorter, and more brutish. And I think our children don't deserve that. We cannot afford that we do another Kyoto on the climate. Of course, the recession is painful, but I think it will end at some point. But our polluted climate may be about to pass beyond the point of no return. Computing power and use of electronics is one of the fastest growing sources of greenhouse gas pollution. Analysts project the ICT sector will grow its carbon emissions by 6% annually, twice the 3% growth seen in the aviation sector. So we have been running a campaign to remove toxins from the production of goods like televisions and computers and to reduce their power consumption. In 2008, we achieved a major success when Apple conducted a U-turn and went green. You might find that surprising, as the Mac had long been the computer brand of choice for hippies and slightly alternative people. But the reality was that Apple was a holdout against greening its productions, methods and design. We knew from studying the dynamics of the industry that Apple, along with Sony, were the innovators. The rest were essentially volume box makers who adopted innovations from them. So we picked Apple for a good reason, because it was a strategic target. In the old days, we would have climbed their offices, occupied their factories, perhaps picketed their shops, which we also did, followed Steve Jobs about and accused Apple of being rotten. Instead, we tried something different. We tried to get their consumers on side. And we knew trying to get them to boycott Apple is about as useless and hopeless as you could imagine. So we ran a campaign based on love, the consumer's love of their Mac. The owners themselves exerted the pressure through a website where the name said it all, www.greenmyapple.com. I love my Apple, I wish it came in green. A wonderful example of a campaign where you just have to have the right title and the right audience, and the campaign runs by itself. And now, Apple has changed substantially. It's not perfect, but it's substantially greener. We think we need to get engaged with corporations, because that helps us to engage the whole sector, and it helps to bring solutions to scale. These conversations and cooperation have attractions for a corporation as well, because who talks seldom bites. And once a personal relationship is built, and of course it's good and useful, the depth of criticism can easily be tempered. After our Print Spark campaign in 1995, in which we stopped Shell dumping a gigantic piece of oil industry debris in the Atlantic, a whole new industry sprang into being: corporate social responsibility. And we believe that we had a substantial influence in helping this new industry develop. Shell, then the fifth largest multinational in the world, began to change and invested heavily in renewables. Its leaders said it saw its future as an energy company, not an oil company. We celebrated, and governments and competitors took notice. International law was changed to close the sea dumping loophole for the oil industry, and also BP changed and famously declared itself beyond petroleum. That was then. As I said the other day to an executive of BP, that they obviously have done another rebranding, and now BP stands for bigger petroleum again. I think they are making a big mistake. But if they want to be a dinosaur, we should treat them as such. In the end, I would like to call upon you on one thing, and that is to show some intolerance. Not aggression or bigotry, but intolerance. Intolerance of excuses of delay or arguments for putting off action in Copenhagen. Intolerance of those who say not yet or not me. This is for others to take a lead in, or only after the Chinese. Intolerance of those practices and technologies which, through actions large and small, weigh down that dark veil that is falling over our children's future. In America in particular, you are going to hear a lot about the likely imperfections of a climate deal. But in this case, the perfect is not just likely to be the enemy of the good, but of the future and of our children. If you were thinking of doing something sometime about climate change, at home or at work or in your family, then however old or young you are, do it this year. Bring it forward, do it now. Make it count for Copenhagen. Because this time, the boat is really leaving. Thank you very much.
That was Gerd Leipold of Greenpeace. Contact the group at area code 202-462-1177 or visit their website at greenpeace.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. As President Barack Obama moves forward with his plan to withdraw many U.S. troops from Iraq, a spike in the number of bombings and assassinations has signaled a reversal of the dramatic decrease in violence seen in the country over recent months. Observers note signs of restiveness by former Sunni insurgents on the U.S. payroll, known as the Sons of Iraq, many of whom have yet to receive jobs promised to them within the Iraqi military, police, and government. On the sixth anniversary of the war in March, more than 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died, 4,200 U.S. servicemen and women have also lost their lives, and over $657 billion has been spent. But in a sign of progress toward the development of institutions of civil society, Iraqi union activists held the nation's first international labor conference in mid-March, where three of the country's major labor organizations announced the formation of a new labor confederation. The two-day labor conference took place in the northern city of Erbil within the Kurdish region, where Iraq's Federation of Oil Unions, the Electricity Association, and the General Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions came together to create a new labor confederation. Among the 200 delegates from Iraq and around the world attending the conference were six observers from America, representing the group U.S. Labor Against the War. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with one of the delegates, Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at New York's Stony Brook University. Professor Zweig discusses the goals of Iraq's new labor confederation and their relationship with U.S. unions.
The goals are to have the broadest possible cooperation and coordination among Iraqi unions as the new Iraqi society emerges, whatever it will look like, and the program that was passed in a series of resolutions called basically for a free and independent and democratic trade union movement in Iraq, and so for a labor law to actually be implemented that gives these unions protections and the right to operate. So that's one point. Another point is to protect Iraqi sovereignty and to protect Iraqi oil and other natural resources and national resources from privatization. They're very strongly committed to that and very resistant to any new oil law that would open up Iraqi oil to ownership or substantial control by foreign companies. So that's a second plank. They are dedicated to a non-sectarian, what they call the non-sectarian, non-ethnic state. So they are not interested in having some kind of Sharia law or other sectarian government and government regulation. They're not interested in having an ethnic-based regime that would be just Arab or just Sunni. They want a broad democratic representation in the government. And that's a very significant development. That's a very, very significant stand that this labor movement is going to pursue as the new Iraqi society unfolds. They have a part of their program, a call for peace and a call for national sovereignty. There is no specific call for an end to American occupation.
What is the attitude of the United States occupation forces and the Iraqi al-Maliki government towards Iraqi unions?
Well, the Saddam Hussein regime in 1987 issued a law that made public sector unions illegal, stripped all legal protection from any workers who were in the oil industry, in transportation, on the docks, all throughout the Iraqi economy, which was almost overwhelmingly in the public sector, about 80% of it. When the U.S. came in 2003, and Paul Bremer was sort of the viceroy there and swept away everything of the Ba'athist regime, they did keep and force that one law, Law 150, from the Saddam Hussein era that prohibited unions in the public sector. And American military authorities and occupation authorities have harassed and challenged Iraqi unions. Although when the Saddam regime fell, the unions did come back up out from under underground from exile and reformed and began to organize anyway. So the constitution, the Iraqi new Iraqi constitution, does provide for unions. It says in the constitution that there should be unions allowed in the country, but there's never been a law passed by parliament to implement that. And the U.S., for all the benchmarks that they've insisted on and all the different political criteria that they impose on or try to impose on the Iraqi government, has never tried to get them to agree to recognize unions. So the occupation and the Maliki government are hostile to these unions, yet, as I say, they are organizing and have successfully protected their members and protected, particularly in the oil fields and on the docks and in the port in Umm Qasr, have pushed back and won real protections for their members.
What are the contacts between this union movement in Iraq and U.S.-based labor unions? I know you traveled and you yourself are a labor activist here, but are there any sort of deep and official contacts yet between the AFL-CIO and other federations here?
Well, the main point of contact between the labor movement in the United States and the Iraqi labor movement is U.S. labor against the war. U.S. law is a coalition, really, of about 190 unions, central labor councils, state feds in the United States. So U.S. law has a long set of relationships going all the way back to 2003 with the Iraqi labor movement. And it was U.S. labor against the war that sent this delegation and raised money to support the conference that was in Iraq. The AFL-CIO, through its Solidarity Center, also has relationships with the Iraqi labor movements, different unions and different federations. And they do trainings usually in Amman, Jordan. There are a number of different channels through which the U.S. labor movement and the Iraqi labor movement are in touch.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. For more information on the Iraqi Labor Conference, visit the website uslaboragainstwar.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Emily Santos-Poplowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.